Good afternoon, everybody. We might have others joining us after the classes. We're really pleased that all of you are here today and that there are more of you here than the panelists that we have. So that's a good start. In typical Indian style, 2 weeks ago, we had one panelist. And so we were considering perhaps we might have to call this event off. And today, we're really delighted that we have all the panelists here, all the experts here this evening to talk to us about the role of India's economy in a changing world. But before we start, I would like to congratulate the Indian societies, LSE Indian Society SPICE, for having put together a fantastic program over the week and scaled it up beyond all the other earlier years with a variety of discussion events as well as cultural events. So I'd like to congratulate, I can't name all of you who were involved, but I'd like to mention a few names. I'd like to mention Sonam, Sanam, who's the president of SPICE, and all her team members. I'd also like to mention the people who arranged the teams itself, the panel events, Aditi Sani, Pooja Sriram and Akshara Sharma, Divya Hariharan. I'd also like to thank Kevin, Divya and Mitali for having worked very hard through the week. Ekan Tyagi has been responsible particularly for this session, and I'd first like to call him to introduce the concept.
Welcome, everybody. The discussion today aims to address two broad points. The role that India is expected to play as an emerging economy in the current uncertain global economic climate, and the internal problems of the Indian economy which have surfaced recently. I would now request Dr. Kattamuri to start the discussion, and I thank all of you for coming today.
So to speak on this topic today, we have six experts here. And I'll also mention the order in which we would be going. We first have Professor Danny Kwa, who is a professor of economics here, and he's going to lay out the overview of the global economy and perhaps refer to an Indian context. And then we'll have Lord Karan Bilimoria. He's been closely involved with Indian business and trade for several years, and he's going to speak from his experience and perhaps give us some introduction to where Cobra Beer is today. If only there had been an extra notice, we might all be having this discussion over a bottle of beer. But we'll pass it this time, maybe next time. But as long as we were together in Patna recently at this Nitish Kumar's conference, and one of the days he was disappearing with Montek to look at the dolphins in Patna. As long as you have your environmental priorities right, you must have got it wrong, Karan. And he's also going to be working on promoting the fact that there are only 2,500 dolphins left in India. So it's going to be one of the things he's been going to be working on together with his business interests. After Karan, we're going to have Mr. Virat Kaul, who's the territorial head for ZTV in the UK and Europe. He'll speak from the media perspective, and following him would be Rahul Sharma, who's the co-founder of Micromax, which perhaps doesn't need much of an introduction. He's also going to speak interestingly about how you might be thinking, for those of you who might be entrepreneurial and wanting to set up your own companies, he's going to give you some tips. And finally, after him, we will have Madhur Jha, who seems like she could be sitting there or in some of our classes. However, she's been a global economist with HSBC for a few years, and she's going to speak from the financial sector perspective. And lastly, we have Tirthankar Roy, who's an economics professor at the LSE. So we start with Danny.
Thank you all very much, and thank you, Ruth, and the Society for organizing this interesting panel discussion. My job, the job that I've been given, is to provide a global or international context to the discussion this afternoon. As Ruth has already told you, we actually have arrayed up on this stage a number of outstanding industry and academic experts on the economy of India in particular, people who've actually hands-on done things in the real world and who will have insights to share with you. I unfortunately do not. I have not had the opportunity to work in India, or and certainly have never had the opportunity to run anything real or productive. But I thought that what I might, so the only way I thought I might be able to add value to the discussion is to give a bit of global background to this discussion of the Indian economy and significantly what problems there might be. Now, the problems that I feel qualified to speak about are not obviously ground-level, hands-on type problems in the Indian economy. I can only speak on this again from the perspective of someone who's an outsider who studies the global economy and who has, you know, who shares certain global perceptions of the Indian economy. So I hope that if in my comments I end up being a little bit maybe more controversial or more provocative or actually even more wrong than you thought could possibly, that you could possibly hear, I hope that you will take it as simply setting the stage for what will be a lively discussion from my fellow panelists. So to begin, I want to talk about, as the title says, how the world has changed and how India places in that world. And pretty much everyone who tries to think about these issues now takes as a touchstone event the 2008 global financial crisis, the 2008 Lehman crisis. And one of the things that the entire world community realized as this crisis unfolded, we became gradually aware of a sensibility that previously had been kicking around only in, well, within investment banks, like Maduro is going to tell you about, or a few other large pools of global capital that studied how the global economy shifted. Most of the rest of us was not aware of this. But this sensibility began to grow until I think I can safely say it has now reached critical mass in world consciousness. What is that sensibility? Well, up until the financial crisis, most people, if you ask them, were already aware of the so-called BRICS phenomenon, Brazil, Russia, India, and China. They're aware of how there was a change in the world in terms of the large, fast-growing countries of the world rapidly converging upwards towards the developed world. Many observers already knew from about a decade ago of the doubling of the world's effective workforce within a very short span of time as India and China respectively unleashed their close to billion people workforce onto global labor markets. And that occurred whether explicitly through globalization or indirectly and just as effectively through the exports of manufactured goods or, as Tom Friedman likes to describe it, via the internet with newly developed workflow software that allowed service providers as well as manufacturing supply chains to become fragmented, finely sliced, and outsourced. And all of this, people were vaguely aware was happening. But up until the 2008 global financial crisis, all of this, in many people's minds, was just a case of poor countries in the world picking off low-hanging fruit. Poor countries in the world like China and India were just doing the easy things. They were growing only because the developed world was willing to buy the cheaper goods and services produced in China, in India, in Brazil, or elsewhere. In Tom Friedman's language, the world was indeed becoming flat. But at the same time, up until 2008, many people viewed that as occurring simply because the world's richest economies found it to their own advantage that the world become flat. So in that view, in the pre-2008 view, high consumption in rich countries provided the global economy's engine of growth. And within that view, when in September 2008, Lehman Brothers filed for bankruptcy, credit markets in developed economies froze. Consumption demand in developed economies fell precipitously. The global economy stalled. Only, of course, the global economy did not stall, at least not everywhere. And this was the first realization among people outside of investment banks, outside of people who studied this as their specialty, that something had changed in the world, something very important that had to do with India and other emerging economies. Between 2008 and 2009, India and China together poured back to world GDP pretty much 100% of what the collapsing US economy took away. Very poor countries were at that point standing toe to toe with the richest countries in terms of providing growth for the global economy. The Eurozone over 2008-2009 collapsed by even more than did the United States. So, after 2009, it was becoming ever more obvious to even people who were not specialists that the transatlantic axis, that imaginary line that was halfway between the United States and Western Europe, the transatlantic axis no longer held the world's economic center. Instead, calculations show that the world's economic center between 1980 and 2010 drifted from its initial base on the transatlantic axis, drifted 5,000 kilometers in 3 decades to, yet last year, now east of the Mediterranean Ocean. And this so-called great shift east of the world's economic center is projected to continue, so that within the next 20 years or so, this world's economic center will settle down in a new location. And where will it settle down? It will settle down on the boundary between India and China. So this dramatic shift in real production, in real incomes, that's something that we all now realize, has unfortunately raced ahead of other features in the global economy. It has raced ahead of global governance, and paradoxically, it has even raced ahead of some features of global finance. So what do I mean by this? I want to briefly describe this and then suggest why this might be a problem, and then zero in on the outside observers' perceptions of problems in the Indian economy. Because today, even as the emerging economies like India assume global economic leadership, global political leadership still continues to reside firmly on the transatlantic axis. And this mismatch is a problem in global governance. In finance, even as, according to some calculations, the emerging world, India, China, the rest of East Asia, now carry 35% of global equity market capitalization, pension funds that are most highly developed in the rich economies, that are the largest single pool of global capital, still show extreme developed economy bias. Pension funds still carry less than 3% of their portfolio in emerging market assets. This is a huge mismatch. Now, in the Great Shift East, nowhere among these new engines of global growth, India or China, has leadership, genuine political leadership, charismatic intellectual leadership, yet been able to gain the trust and confidence of the rest of the world. India and China are the only billion people economies in the world. India and China are among the world's fastest growing economies. And we realize now that happens through global crisis and through non-global crisis. They are not simply riding on the coattails of high consumption in the rich economies anymore. But these new engines of growth don't pull together, and they project vastly different visions of the world. India is the world's largest democracy. China's ruling Communist Party is the world's largest political party. And right here, we get our segue into the problems in the Indian economy, viewed from an outside perspective. What are those problems? In an interview in 2007, Lee Kuan Yew, Singapore's former Prime Minister, noted how India has historically had a global stakes lead over China, and indeed over the rest of the world, over the rest of the emerging world. Lee Kuan Yew pointed out how even though India's annual growth has been 8 to 9% for the previous 5 years when he was speaking, this peaceful rise in India has not led to unease about the country's future. The rest of the world is hugely optimistic about India. Instead, he said, Americans, Japanese, Western Europeans, all the traditional transatlantic axis economic powers are keen to invest in India, to ride on India's growth, to help develop another heavyweight country. Lee Kuan Yew, at that point, noted how, in contrast, China's growth has raised all kinds of apprehensions, political and economic. Bottom line is, India appeals to the global community. And because of this, India has a rich version of what the Harvard political scientist Joseph Nye calls soft power. India has soft power in quantities that China can only envy. Now, here now is the difficulty. Has India been able to capitalize on this soft power advantage in the world? And now I become a little bit more pessimistic, a little bit less rosy in my assessment. Because unfortunately, when you look at the hard numbers in contrast to the soft power, the promise of India remains still brighter than the reality. Today, everyone knows India to be the computers, telecommunications, IT outsourcing center of the world. But here's the fact. India's internet users relative to the local, to India's population, that is less than one-third China's. India's higher education enrollment as a fraction of the relevant age group is less than one-half that of China's. India's adult literacy rate relative to China is only two-thirds. 30 years ago, India's per capita GDP was double that of China. The number of people extremely poor in India was half that of China. By last year, these numbers had almost exactly reversed. So even in the light of this great shift east, even as India continues to pull its weight in moving the world's center of gravity, what has gone wrong? Why has India not been able to capitalize on how the rest of the world has viewed it so rosily? There's a sharp difference between how the rest of the world views India and how perhaps India's own population sees it. The Washington-based Pew Research Center carries out annual surveys of global attitudes. It does this in different countries around the world. In 2011, when the Pew people from Washington asked Indians what they thought of the direction their country was headed, and this was in 2011, slightly more than half said that they were satisfied. That meant that about half were unsatisfied. In contrast, every year since 2008, more than 85% the Chinese surveyed by Pew say they are satisfied with their country's direction. This is a sharp contrast between what is, on the one hand, the world's largest democracy, where a government and political leadership is supposed to be popularly elected, versus a country where even the most casual observer will remark, is a bureaucracy that does not directly engage with the common people. Now, just out of interest, I also asked Pew for the numbers on the United States. And you might be interested to know that the fraction of satisfied Americans have never risen above 36% since 2008. So, in this regard, India's leadership is actually doing much better than American leadership. But of course, that might not be saying very much. Now, the point of this comparison is not to be joyless, but to try and map out the realm of greater possibilities. So what are my last concluding comments on what the realm of greater possibilities is? India, while remaining firmly democratic, has not allowed very basic, very transparent market forces to play any significant role in determining important economic outcomes. This is in contrast to how the rest of the emerging world behaves. Now, the rest of the emerging world actually shows hugely diverse variety of economic models. China is different from Indonesia, is different from Hong Kong and Singapore. But Hong Kong and Singapore share the same English colonial heritage as does India. They have, however, not been averse to taking the best ideas and accepting investment from the West. And both have succeeded spectacularly in the past. When outside observers look at India, they remark on how India's huge advantages are twofold. First, it has a relatively younger population than all the rest of the emerging world, China in particular. And second, it has an advantage in the English language and a culture of freewheeling creativity, useful in the most promising of growth industries, telecoms and information technology. But I would argue that here too there are dangers. Contrary to popular opinion, widespread opinion on the so-called demographic dividend in terms of India's younger population, even this might work against India's economic prospects. If that youth bulge continues to face jobless growth, and it responds with social unrest. And even in industries like telecommunications, where Indian innovation and success have shown the way ahead for the rest of the world, we know that backroom machinations and corrupt practices have come to light that recently led to a disruptive withdrawal of all 2G spectrum licenses awarded some years back. So I think there are problems. Post 2008, the Washington consensus no longer holds. There's no longer one model to run economic development. India, it seems to me, shows among the most promising of compromises. It has a vibrant democracy, it holds on to liberal political ideals, and it shows thoughtful economic guidance, a Mahalanobis derived history of planning that in other countries has shown to be successful. It is hugely frustrating for an outside observer why there is not more progress. But I think these same ingredients tell us that when one day India does assume the economic leadership and thought leadership for the rest of the world post-2008 crisis, that will be good for India and it will be good for the world. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for the welcome, and great to be here. The title of the role of the Indian economy in a changing world, it's really changing India that we're talking about. And I started Cobra Beer in 1989. I'd finished my studies. I had a degree from India, degree at Cambridge, chartered accountancy with Ernst & Young, and I set up a beer business. And of course, I got no support from my family whatsoever. I remember my father by this stage was Commander-in-Chief of the Central Indian Army in Lucknow, and I was developing Cobra Beer in Bangalore early part of 1990, and I would go up to see my parents every time I got a bit of a break from developing the product, And I knew my father, being an army officer, could not support me financially. At our wedding, he said, I didn't have to dissuade my sons from joining the army, I just showed them my paycheck. And no, I said, let me get some emotional support. Dad, I've started my own business, my own beer brand. What are you doing? All this education. And you're becoming an import-export wallah. Get a proper job. Become a banker. We won't go there. So, you see, when I started Cobra, 1989-90, I knew always that India was going to take off one day as an economy. I knew that the India that I was brought up in as a child, that closed, protected, insular, inward-looking economy, would one day open up. And sure enough, in 1991, it did. And we've heard from the professor the Washington Consensus. There was that element to it, but India opened up. And here we are last year celebrating the 20th anniversary of India's liberalization. And Cobra started in 1990, and it's very much part of that opening up of India's story. And in 2003, I was appointed as the co-chair of the Indo-British Partnership. My Indian co-chair was Narayan Murthy of Infosys. It's now the UK-India Business Council, of which I'm president. And I remember when I was appointed in 2003, I found it really frustrating. This is, 9 years ago, everyone was talking about China, China, China. No one was talking about India. They were not interested in India. And in 2003, I started doing a course at the Harvard Business School, the President's Leadership Program. I eventually graduated last year, a bit of a slow learner. But, again, Harvard Business School, at that time, it was all China, China. We'd do case studies about China or featuring Chinese companies. Why aren't you talking about India? And of course, eventually, the world woke up to India. When I say eventually, we're talking about 4 or 5 years ago. Today, the dean of the Harvard Business School is an Indian. So the world's moved on. Now, I've just come back. Ruth and I were in Bihar. And I set up a brewery. I bought a brewery in Bihar. And I signed a joint venture with Molson Coors, one of the world's largest brewers. And we bought this brewery in June last year. And we've been upgrading it. When I said to people, especially my Indian friends, my family, guess what? Brewery in Bihar. Bihar? Any Biharis here? Come on, well done, fantastic. Proud to be Bihari. People say, what are you doing there? Are you mad? Some people say, have you got kidnap insurance? Are you taking armed guards with you? And 7 years ago, those comments would have been absolutely appropriate. And I probably would have needed armed guards. And the state was a basket case. Today, in 6 years, crime has gone down 6 times. Today, the whole of India is looking at Bihar as a turnaround story. So there is a lot of change taking place. And this has all been through the leadership of Nitish Kumar, the Chief Minister, and Sushil Modi, the Deputy Chief Minister, and their team. And they've just turned the state around. And from a basket case, it's now a basket of opportunity. At this conference, one of the individuals speaking was Javed Akhtar. You know who I'm talking about? There was a remarkable man who was a member of the Rajya Sabha in India. And he was talking, this was a session on culture and creative industries in India and the cultural renaissance. And he said, you know something? You can trace the socio-political history of India through the villains in Hindi movies. You see, in the 50s, around that time, the villains were the zamindars, the landowners. Then in the 1960s, the villains were the mill owners. Then in the 1970s, the gangsters were the villains. By the 1980s, the gangsters became the heroes. Then you go into the 1990s, and the politicians became the villains. Then he said, now we've got no villains. But the point is, in Bihar, the politicians are now the heroes. How things have changed and how India has changed. And I think that, where Cobra is concerned, 3 years ago, I started Cobra Beer in 1990, started with absolutely nothing, built it up, and 3 years ago, I nearly lost the whole lot. And it was a disastrous, disastrous time. And luckily, we saved the company, and I signed a joint venture with one of the world's largest brewers, Molson Coors. The owners of Carling over here, Coors Light, they own the biggest brewery in the world in outside Denver and Colorado. And we signed this JV in India as well, and things are going fantastically well now. And the JV in India is called Molson Coors Cobra, MCC. And looking back to 2003, when I took over the chairmanship of the Indo-British Partnership, and of course we're pushing for liberalization. And here's the sad truth. What liberalization has happened in India since 2003? I challenge you. Oh, yes, there is one. 2004, air services opened up between the UK and India. Before that, you had two airlines to choose from, direct flights to India, Air India, British Airways, and 19 flights a week. Today, you've got several airlines to choose from and over 119 flights per week. And what a difference that's made. Well, what about everything else? Foreign law firms still can't practice in India. Lloyd's of London, the most important reinsurance market in the world. India is the only major country in the world they cannot operate in. Foreign banks can only open up a handful of branches in India. Insurance, the insurance bill is still pending. Oh, India, huge capacity required in higher education. What's happened to the higher education bill? There are foreign universities queuing up, waiting to go into India to participate in the expansion there. India needs it. We've got universities from all over the world, including here, who want to participate. Oops, the bill is stuck. FDI in retail, at long last, it came through. Oh dear, pull back 2 weeks later. So the reforms, I'm afraid to say, have stalled. And I think that's really holding India back. Infrastructure desperately needs $1 trillion of investment. That investment will come once these reforms take place more and more. And the knock-on effect of reforms, the FDI in retail, would actually go all the way back to the farmer in terms of the improvements in the cold chain, the storage, the infrastructure. In my own instance, in Bihar, we've set up a brewery. You set up a brewery, we've upgraded it, doubled its capacity in 8 months. Immediately you create employment and indirect employment. Then, if you attract others to come in, we're the first multinational to come to Bihar. You get more multinationals coming into Bihar, you get more breweries coming into Bihar. Orissa has 5 breweries. Bihar, a state of 100 million people, has 1 brewery. You get 4 or 5 breweries, and guess what I discovered? In Bihar, they grew barley. But the barley is useless for beer. It's enough, good enough for feed. We get our barley from Haryana, North India. We could grow barley 20 kilometers away from our brewery. So if there are enough breweries, you can set up a malting plant, and the Bihar farmers can grow high value-added crops, which is barley, which we would buy from them. We'd win, they'd win. This is the knock-on effect when you liberalize things, when you open up. And that's the power of it. And you know, where beer is concerned, the Bihar beer consumption is 0.5 liter per person per year. Okay, India's 1.5 liters per person per year. China in 1978, when it started its economic opening up, was 0.5 liter per person per year. Today, China is 35 liters per person per year. And the biggest beer market in the world, with 400 million hectoliters, and India is at 20 million hectoliters. And by the way, 35 is nothing. We're about a 90 over here. And that's nothing. The Germans are 150 liters per person per year. So there's huge, huge potential. And by the way, our new Cobra commercial, watch this space. Next week, we've got a brand new TV commercial coming out, and it's all shot in India. So I'd love some feedback from all of you when you see it. I sit on the Prime Minister of India's Global Advisory Council, and at our annual meeting this year, one of the points that was brought out by Professor Kishore Mehbubani, who I'm sure Danny knows, and it came out in the discussion that, you know, as the world is changing, and as this movement east, as you said, the line is going to be somewhere between China and India, India has benefited from globalization. As the West is getting more protectionist, India should take up the mantle of being the champion of globalization. What an opportunity for India to do that, but I think it's got to be proactive to do that, and it's got to be leadership. And leadership, the big difference between management and leadership, management is doing things right, leadership is doing the right thing. So can India do the right thing and take this mantle? And again, in Bihar, I've seen this. Sushil Modi, the Deputy Chief Minister, said when they took on this disastrous situation 6.5 years ago, and he said to Nitish Kumar, Chief Minister, what's our number one priority going to be? Nitish Kumar replied, governance. What's the number two priority going to be? He replied, governance. What's the number three priority going to be? He replied, governance. And that's what it's about. When you get that faith in leadership and you have that governance, you can do absolutely anything. And again, Danny spoke about the soft power of India. India has so much going for it, the democracy, the free press, the rule of law, and it's got a whole amount. But the big difference is the India of 1998, when the Asian financial crisis took place, that India didn't get affected by the Asian financial crisis. India was insulated still. It had only just opened up from the world economy. 2008, when the financial crisis took place, India got hit badly. And looking ahead now, my worry is the subprime crisis led to the credit crunch, led to the financial crisis, led to the Great Recession, led to the sovereign debt crisis, led to the Eurozone crisis, is going to lead to God knows what in contagion. If that happens, which I sadly think will happen, I'm afraid to say that India is going to get affected. But the bottom line is India's GDP even now has slowed down to 7%. Gosh, we'd give anything for that. We can't even get 0.7% here. But it's the GDP per capita that's the important thing. It's this India's growth rate focus. I mean, Amartya Sen brought out a fantastic paper. What's the point of growth rate if your basic indicators, and in India, if you look at the basic indicators and you compare India's basic indicators with countries like Bangladesh, countries like Sri Lanka, in areas of literacy, in areas of malnutrition, India, sad to say, is still right very, very low down. So it's got a long way to go with 300 million people still living on less than a dollar a day. And that's where I get frustrated, where we lost the typhoon deal. By the way, that's really unfortunate. The Typhoon's a great aircraft. I believe it's a better aircraft between the Rafale and the Typhoon. I think a mistake was made because in the consortium of Germany, Italy, and Spain and Britain, Germany had the lead to make the sale to India. I think it would have been much better if Britain had the lead, because we've got a very strong, long-standing association with the Indian Air Force. It would have made sense. It didn't happen. And Rafale's a good aircraft. The Typhoon's a better aircraft. We didn't get the deal. And then there were these remarks that came out that, oh, we give so much aid to India and we can't even win a fighter aircraft deal. Well, that's absolute nonsense. That one has got nothing to do with the other. If we give help to another country, we don't expect to win business deals in return. And where aid is concerned, I think it's an outdated term where India is concerned, because the Department for International Development, what that does in India is not aid, it's actually partnership development work. In Bihar, for example, the Right to Public Services Act was actually brought about with the help of DFID. Now DFID is helping train teachers. They're recruiting 300,000 teachers, and the training of those teachers is with the help of DFID. So it's not aid, and it's development work. So I'm going to now conclude, my 10 minutes are up, in saying that India has huge challenges, but some people fail because of, and other people succeed in spite of. And I think in spite of all India's challenges, in spite of all these liberalizations, reforms being stalled, India is still succeeding. It's a one-way consumer-driven momentum, which I don't think is going to stop. And I think the essence of it all, is now there is an aspiration that exists amongst the Indian youth. I gave a talk at the Pravasi Bharatiya Divas in Jaipur to 700 youngsters in Jaipur, college students, medical students. And the enthusiasm of those 700, when I said to them, how many of you want to start your own business, 75% of the hands went up. When I said, how many of you want to study abroad, 100% of the hands went up. That is India's future. And I think with that, India has nothing to stop India's success. Thank you.
Mr. Virat Kaur.
Thank you, Karan. Good evening, all. After the broad statistics and the information on the world economy, what I would do is to cut back and try and hit the media industry right away, and within that, what is the role and what is the place of ZTV, which I am working for. So among the data put in, what ails, let me do the bad news first, which is the what ails the Indian economy. Put it in relation to the media. Point number one, population growth, very high population growth. From the media side, thank you very much. More population, more eyeballs, more turnover. I mean, this is a worldwide phenomena, and if it's in India, faster, or in China, that's even better. It's $314 billion is the industry worldwide. As the imaginary line was shifting in the media world, the ad world in media, it has already shifted. The Asia-Pacific region today delivers about 29 billion of advertising revenue through TV, while the Europe and Americas deliver about 25.5. 27 million on the Asia-Pacific is going to be in the next 4 years to 60 billion US. So automatically the population, as far as the yes, it affects the economy, agreed, but as far as the media industry concerned, it would add value, which the figures are proving, and that's the way we are going ahead. In India, the media industry again is growing faster than the GDP. The figures quoted are between 7 to 8.5%. Media is definitely growing at about 11.5%, double digit always moving forward. So you are in the high growth area in terms of the total economy. Another problem in terms of unemployment, very high in India. Yes, that affects us. However, there was a report published by Nielsen's just a year ago, which showed that during unemployment, which means your disposable income is less, the first thing you cut back is on buying clothes, then you cut back on vacations, then you cut back on eating out, followed by entertainment outside, then you cut back finally on groceries. So in-home entertainment, which the media industry represents in terms of TV and in terms of radio, the in-home bit is even below your groceries. Everyday groceries, you will start alternating using lower brands. But so therefore, yes, disposable income low, unemployment effects, but we are way down the scale. And it is very surprising to note that people are readjusting their eating habits, but not their viewing habits. So that is the other part. The other point is where we would be riding on as an industry is on the technology. Technology, I was having a chat with Rahul as to how the iPad or the tablet really seems to be converging, and already the media industry is getting stuff ready. You can see on your tablets in terms of all the phones, separate, so a three and a half hour film will be reduced, or the serials could be reduced, which you would be seeing already on the net. So the new technology in terms of the new media opportunities, definitely a growth factor, which if you add all this up, we are ahead of the GDP, as I said earlier. So the technology bit is really helping us in moving the industry forward, and wherever we can get in, and the faster you get in as a company or as a group, that helps. One of the other ills is, of course, the policy, as Karan very clearly mentioned, that delays in policies, approvals, and then pullbacks. So what do? So one, as an industry, we said, okay, we can crib about it, we can cry and complain to the world at large. What we have done as a group in India is we found one of the largest joint ventures in India, which consists of Zee, Star, and Turner channels. The basic idea of this group is to actually push the government into digitization, which is the next big thing in India in terms of technology. 214, we are trying to figure out that we must make sure that that deadline is met instead of slipping to 220, as things would slip. The idea is there's the Indian Broadcasting Federation, the three biggies are trying to, through that, move the government that we must digitize and move forward. Why is that? That is really because of the addressable population in terms of subscription revenue. India is one of the few countries where the advertising revenues are higher than subscription revenue. The paid channel revenues, which is exactly the case across Europe, etc., or the US, its subscription is much higher. So we're trying to put that because if people are familiar with Delhi, you have the cable operators and a million other people there who just run and give you a connection in your house. Now, these people will not pay us, which is the media companies, the correct amount of money. They will always talk about that we have only 10 subscribers. In fact, it's only reported subscribers is about 12 to 15% of actual. So All the industry on subscription in India gets about 12 to 15% of the total collections, which is picked up from a customer from your house. So that would be corrected. So technology, there is the JV which is there, and the prime objective of the JV is to ensure that the technology comes in place on time. The costs attached to it are very huge. What have we done as a group? We have the largest DTH operation in India is again by Zee, called Dish TV, all across India. So that is increasing at a very fast pace, and which is exactly moving the digitization forward. So if the cable people don't, between all the DTH operators combined, Star, of course, has the Sky, Tata is a close cousin brother to them. So pretty much the strengths are coming together, and the prime objective is how do we get around this slow giant, or many times the corrupt inverted commas, and in fact in the telecom sector, as we keep here reading about it, I think that is what it is. So pretty much on the media side, in spite of the professed economic slowdown, I wouldn't say hitting a recession, but yeah, economic slowdown, because as we were just told that the percentage growths have come down. I think the media industry seems to be at the right side. One of the ways, as our group, and I think all the other groups also do, is basically looking at inspired leadership and innovation being the cornerstones of the Zee Group, and as well as I think the other industry. Just to tell you among the number of firsts, post-liberalization, we were in 1992, everybody till then was just watching Doordarshan. The first channel on the ground was Zee TV. In fact, Ruth was very surprised when I told her. At that point of time, it went international. The office here, which I am working out of, was opened in 1995. So before the first international operation by any company out of India was in UK, in London, in 1995. So the internationalization was thought of that time. And of course, now we are across 163 countries with offices from Africa to US to Singapore, Australia, everywhere. So, and secondly, we are already thinking about why only the ethnic or the South Asian population, why not the other communities, why not as a larger TV. And channels have been bought over. Sorry,
it's not such a big deal. Just one, it was about time.
Okay, sorry. So already in the process of have bought over channels abroad in the US, and then we are broadcasting them across the world. So pretty much since I've just been now. So it's what I was talking about is the innovation. I try to link up the challenges to the industry, and in terms of numbers, I think the China-India story is very clear, that that's the way the world is moving. And in conclusion, yes, these figures are very good. If you look at the profitability figures of the company, we are growing at about 37% in terms of revenue and 35% in terms of EBITDA. But the investors, I think, still are a bit cagey in terms of investing in the India media scene. Part of it is because the HD or the technology push is going to be costing a bomb, and they do see that everything will get digitized, and post that the returns would come. So I don't think they're ready to wait at the moment for returns, and therefore to conclude that in spite of a very good future for the media industry, at the moment the investors are the only people who do not believe. I think I'll rest my case there. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Urad. Good afternoon, friends. It's an honor and privilege to be here and sharing the dais with all the distinguished guests. My name is Rahul Sharma, and I'm co-founder for Micromax Mobiles Limited. It's a mobile handset company based out of India. As Ruth has already raised an alarm for the timing, so I'd like to be very brief and quick on this. I'll share some details on India as a land of opportunity, what it can provide, and if you can identify the gaps and can fill the gaps, then the sky is the limit. So I'll just start this with a whole brief of how we started this organization. And 10 years back or so, when I finished my engineering, a very similar circumstances as Mr. Billy Muria, my dad was a retired school principal, and I said, "Dad, I want to start my own company." And he said, "Beta, why?" So I said, "I have some, you know, some dreams which I want to fulfill." And so he allowed me, and we started this company as Micromax Software. It's a software company. This is in 1999, when everybody was doing software. I traveled to the United States. I was staying with one of my uncles who used to work with Sun Microsystems. It was this maid at my uncle's home. She used to watch CNBC and you know, all the stocks for Yahoo and all. And I was thinking, what the hell is going on? I've never, you know, followed the stocks and everything those days. So those were some crazy days. We were working on e-commerce, and it was a very dynamic industry. And every 6 months, something was changing. So after 6 months, the dot-com burst was happening, and then we realized, hey, we have to change the industry. And in terms of the technology, we changed from e-commerce to ERPs. Then again, from ERPs, we moved on to embedded technology. And so embedded technology is a combination of hardware and software. So you write a software, put it on a hardware to make the chip or device smarter. We did that, and it was going fine. In 2003 or so, Nokia appointed us as an R&D for their M2M, machine-to-machine business, and we started making and doing R&D for Nokia. Things were going fine. We were making some products on GSM, which were powering the payphone machines in India for the carriers like Airtel and Vodafone. And things were moving pretty good for us till 2007 or so. I was in a village in West Bengal, and I was passing by through this village going back to the airport, and I saw this payphone which was running in a village where there was no electricity. I stopped my cab and I just walked in and asked the guy. I said, "How are you running this payphone? There's no electricity in this village." He showed me a big truck battery on the back. He says, "I'm drawing power from here." Those days we used to carry Nokia phones. So there was no signal, weak signal area. So I said, "There's no signal. How are you drawing the signals?" He showed me a big 20 dB gain antenna with some 20 meters of wire wounded on top of his terrace. He said, "I'm drawing signals from here." I got more intrigued. I asked him, I said, "Which is fine, but then how do you charge the battery? No electricity." He said, 11 kilometers away, there's a village. I put this battery on my bicycle every night. I go there, charge whole night, and then I come back in the morning. And I said, "Fine, how much money do you make?" He said, "Some 3,000-4,000 rupees, which is less than $100. But it is a huge money for a village where there's no electricity. This means no mode of entertainment, no TV, nothing. But they still have telephony. Then I was traveling in the interiors of Bihar, and I saw people having chargers of all makes, and then on top of that was written that pay 25 rupees to charge your mobile phones. I came back to our head office in Delhi, and one of our co-founders, I just asked him, I said, "Sumit, why can't we make mobile handset, which will last, which will have a long battery?" So initially, all my other co-founders then said, he said, are you mad? Who's going to buy a mobile phone written Micromax on top of it? Are you going to use it?" I said, "I'm not the user. The users are sitting somewhere else." I was allowed to make first 10,000 handsets internally. And that's how Micromax Mobile, in terms of mobile handset, was born. We made our first mobile handset, which had a battery backup for 1 month. 1 month battery backup, and then we started selling these mobile handset in rural India. We were not doing any marketing, nothing, because we were not having budgets to do that. In first 10 days, everything was sold out, just by word of mouth. And that's how we realized that what a humongous opportunity this is. And nobody has ever realized that if you can customize the flavor as per the Indian requirements, you can crack these markets. Because Indian markets were, by then was fed by, food cooked in Finnish factory or maybe in Korean factories. So that's how, from those 10,000 handsets or so, then we came up with handsets with dual SIM, dual standby. We came up with handsets, 1 minute.
No, actually 0 minutes.
Okay. So from those days, from selling 10,000 handsets a month, now we sell around a million handsets a month. We are from one country, we are there in 13 countries now, from incubating these new divisions. So in terms of, as you know, as a land of opportunity, I think India is a humongous market, and if you can identify those gaps and can fill those gaps, sky is the limit. And as Dal was saying, that India, in terms of internet penetration and all this, is still around 1/3. But if you 1/3 of China, but if you look at the opportunity, that's a massive opportunity. So I'll just summarize this: dream big and follow your passion. And I think this is much to do. If you follow your passion, the sky's the limit. Thank you so much.
Hey, afternoon, everyone. Very briefly, I'm Madhur Jha. I work with HSBC. I'm a global economist there. So I'll very quickly ask, how many of you actually want to work with a bank? That's good. Bank's not a bad term here then. right. I'll keep it very brief because, I've not had an illustrious career as other members of this team, but maybe you can relate a little bit more to me because I'm maybe same age as you to some extent, as Rahul was. I started work about 11, 12 years ago after I did my master's in economics. I worked in India for about 4 or 5 years, 4 years, and I've worked here for 8 years. And I can tell you that the Indian landscape has absolutely changed in a lot of ways. It's not just because whenever I go back there, I feel poorer for living in India and seeing everybody, all my other friends actually buying and consuming and doing what they need to do. And I over here stuck in the UK economy feel, I can't actually afford all that purchases anymore. But it's more to do with the fact that when I started working, no one in the industry ever would accept the fact that actually a developed economy could default or that emerging markets could look safe. It was inconceivable. I was asked in an interview once, do you really think a European economy can actually ever default? That's just not possible. And that's how things have evolved over time. Things have changed. India is progressing. And we put out a report, which is The World in 2050, and we say that India should be the fourth largest country by 2050. Now, of course, whenever you put out a projection that goes that far out, you have to take it with a lot of salt, because if I was to make the same projection in 1910 about 1950, I wouldn't have thought of the two world wars or the Great Depression. So clearly, there are lots of things that could go wrong. But the good thing about the report is that it's based on fundamentals. It's based on what are your demographics like? And your demographics in India are wonderful. Over the next 40 years, the working population goes up by 40%. You've got amazing entrepreneurship there, very good education levels for the highly educated, but clearly there are problems as well. And that's what I will focus on over here to a little bit. I mean, I've been working here 8 years. As I said, I've worked in India as well. Whenever I meet all my clients, we have very regular seminars where we ask people, look, you're interested in emerging markets, which are the emerging markets you're really interested in? And everybody says, great law system based on the English law in India, amazing fact that you've got English language there, you've got very skilled people who are very hardworking, all of that's really wonderful. But when we ask them, will you actually set up business there, they prefer not to. And the reason, very simply, is because first, they think there's just too much red tapeism. And secondly, they're really, really worried about corruption. So these are, I think, the two biggest drawbacks that you do hear very, very often from people in the industry. And I'm talking about various industries. I'm not just talking about banking. I'm talking about industries in general, because my clients tend to be people from all walks of life, whether they're hedge funds, the private sector, anywhere. And I think that this is important because this is what hopefully needs to change. And I'm very happy to see that there is a movement in India happening against corruption starting this year. And that's, I think, what people are really, really willing to see come through. And the other two things, of course, is infrastructure and the lack of education. You've got this amazing population growth, you've got this amazing working age population growth coming through, but you really need to see education levels come through. Only 17% of India's workforce has completed secondary education, and that's a very, very low figure. I mean, that's really shockingly low. And we are all guilty of it. Hopefully you won't be. But there has been a brain drain of the people who can, who are the highly educated to the outside world. A lot of my friends, of course, are now moving back into India because they do realize the opportunities that India gives. So a lot of my friends who worked abroad for 10 years, 12 years, who actually just after doing their masters got placed abroad, they're all moving back because they see the potential. And, you know, that's a big positive that's coming through. But clearly...